Welcome to Shazam, the podcast that hopes to make itself obsolete. I'm your host, Kayla Drescher. I cannot believe I got to speak with this legend of magic. And it begins in 3, 2, 1. There, and what a week it has been. Oh goodness. Here, I just started another round of Magic Castle classes. So I teach 2 classes once a week for 6 weeks. And I really enjoy teaching adults who have never really done magic before, or at least don't know a lot of methods. And I think it's really fun watching them click into understanding how difficult magic is and how much magicians have to understand about their audience in order to do something really entertaining and fooling and all of that. So it's really fun to watch them. And I feel like teaching magic gives people this new respect for what magicians do. And I love it. I mean, I can just think of the time that I really didn't learn how to do the Diablo juggling, you know, the hourglass on a string on 2 sticks. That is hard. And so now when I see someone juggle a Diablo, multiple Diablos, I'm like, wow, I just have a newfound respect. And as soon as you learn how something is done, I think it's really cool. You get to learn like, oh, wow, these people work really hard. And I think it's super fun to teach people magic. So that's great. That's what's been going on here. And I absolutely love it. And you know what else I love? This episode. Our guest this week is a magician and activist. You may know her from her trade show and corporate event fame, where she was nicknamed the darling of .com. Teller said, "She is not only beautiful and funny, she is clever." And that is certainly the truth. She's been on Entertainment Tonight, Good Morning America, featured in Entrepreneur Magazine, The Wall Street Journal, Genie Magazine, The International Conjurers Magazine, just to name a few. In an international trade event, she was awarded Most Entertaining, Biggest Crowds, Best Audience Response, and Best Product Integration. She is the first woman to lecture and perform at FISM. She's played every room at the Magic Castle. Honestly, she's just a magic legend. She also focuses on her foundation, Cause to Wonder, whose mission statement is, by producing curious, creative, collaborative, cross-cultural public performances and events, we leverage the human tendency to be novelty-seeking to facilitate the exchange of ideas that can reduce human suffering. Make sure you check out Cause to Wonder, linking it in the show notes. Lisa talks a lot about it in this episode, and honestly, it's just a fantastic thing to support. So let's get to it. Please welcome Lisa Mena.
Do you have any questions or anything that you want to talk about before we officially start?
How do you feel about having lived your dream already?
Wait, I'm interviewing you.
I know, but that's, you said if I have any questions. I want to know. I mean, come on. Lots of people say I have this dream. It's very rare in my life where I meet a woman. She says, this is my dream. And then I catch up with her a decade later and she's lived it.
Do you know what's funny? I just did an interview for another podcast and I was asked, oh, well, it's everybody's dream to be in a touring show. You're done. Your career's done. And I'm like, but I'm 30. That's no. And so I had to talk about like, what's next?
Well, then you're interviewed by a limited thinker.
Oh, yes. Sorry. The interviewer was mentioning this very sarcastically, saying, well, you must be done, right? So thank goodness he understood. Obviously, I'm not. But yes, I think a lot of people would be like, oh, yeah, this is the end, the ultimate dream.
Well, and I certainly was told I needed to retire by 30. I remember Goshman said, you don't want to be a sheep in lamb's clothing. And then he made reference to some other women in magic who were desperately trying to stay young. And I was like, Goshman, you got to shut up, man. You're just a dinosaur. He was from a different era. He said, you'll never make a living as a magician. And then I told him what I was charging and he said, I take it back.
When you prove your finances, he's like, never mind. You do what you got to do.
Yeah, you do anything you want now. You don't need to get married. I know. Nope.
I love that. Normally I start by going, hi, Lisa, but we've already started because that was a fantastic way to start. So hi, Lisa.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, I'm doing so well. This is so, I'm so happy you're here. This is great. I know we had lunch many, many years ago, but I've also just been sitting on the idea of one day I'm going to interview Lisa Mena on this podcast.
With public questions in mind.
Public questions. Yeah. Big time public questions. I'm so excited.
The answer is yes. Go for it. That's the answer to any question.
Great. And that's the end of this podcast. Thank you so much for listening.
Don't forget to tip the waiters.
I love it. So where are you currently?
Well, this podcast is being recorded at the 10th month of COVID, which is the height of the pandemic. According to the Spanish flu, we'll have our 2 million deaths in the next 2 months. And so I am sheltered in place, as any good citizen who can be is, in the Caribbean. I am a half a mile from any other human being by myself on a beach. I have 6 wild donkey that visit me regularly, a bunch of iguanas, some hermit crabs, a fishing pole, and some fruit trees, and I'm good. But boy, am I rugged. I'll tell you what, I can catch and kill a fish in a minute. I had a shark in my fish trap the other day.
What?
Yeah. Well, because I left the fish trap in the water too long. Fish got in. Shark went in to get the fish. Couldn't get out. And he was big. He was as big as me.
So is this sort of like an ideal life for you? Because for me, this sounds ideal. Nobody else around.
This house has been in my family since I was a child. And so I have stayed here often by myself. And I'm used to spending 5 or 6 days without any other person because of living here. And it's so far away. And after the hurricanes and things, I was sometimes months without electricity living here. So no phone, no internet. So for many years, I trained for being able to be alone by myself at the end of the earth with nobody to bother me. So I don't freak out by loneliness or anything. But I have found an exquisite deliciousness of not having the pressure to produce anything. Right? Mm. Like, I don't have any idea that I'm going to come out the end of the other side of this pandemic with a book written or this or that. I don't feel any of that pressure at all. Although I am on level 2 in Duolingo learning Italian.
That's so much further than I've ever gotten with any language on Duolingo. So that's very impressive.
It is very impressive, I know. Just this morning, the Duolingo sign popped up in my thing and I was like, damn you, Duolingo. I don't wanna, but I did it.
That's so cool. So what does magic look like for you right now?
Well, I don't feel the need to be productive, but I did memorize Juan's stack.
Oh, every that's morning a I get good up, one.
I do windmills and I touch my toes and I pick a suit or I pick a number or I pick a letter and I start and I go through the deck. So, and which is great because I don't know that I'll ever be interested in Zoom shows, but if I do, a memorized deck is a lot more possibilities than anything else that you can see on a card trick. But in the end, you really just find the card at the selected location. That's all there is.
Right.
6 of hearts, 26. Okay. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There it is. Wow. Trick over.
The end. That's what I worked on for 10 months.
Well, no. And I've been working on loaves and fishes. I've been working on it for a while, but I have been working on loaves and fishes.
Great.
And I've been doing a few shows on a kayak. We have super yachts that come out in the bay. And I kayak out, so I tie my boat to their back of their boat, and then they hang over the thing, and I've been doing some shows that way, but mostly for the novelty of doing shows.
So the Zoom show is not your thing? You'd prefer the kayak show?
I haven't done a real Zoom show. I've done a couple of magic tricks on Zoom for people's friends' parties. It was a birthday, or somebody's kid is depressed. The other day, I got my first inquiry from some agent I never heard of, and I was like, you should know I haven't done this before. And they're like, what? And I'm like, well, you don't want me to pretend that I have. I'm pretty sure I can do a pretty good job, but I haven't done it before. I'd practice first. It's 2 weeks away, right? They did not call back. But I suspect that it was not a real gig. I suspect it was somebody fishing for information.
Oh, yeah. I've definitely gotten a couple of those where people are literally just going, how much are you charging?
Are you doing a Zoom show?
No, I'm not intensely marketing them, but the holiday season is coming up and I'm definitely getting some regular clients asking, some new clients asking. So I do have that. And I've also done a couple guest appearances. Like I've done the Chicago Magic Lounge. I'm about to do the Magic Castle one. So yes, but I'm not trying to make that a thing because I hate them.
Well, what if we could make it a way that you didn't hate them? That's what I'm thinking. I mean, seems obvious to me that the next generation of entertainment will be every Friday night, I pour a glass of wine and I talk to my friends. And anybody who wants to join me can pay $5 and be part of the conversation or whatever it is. I mean, I'm sure there's going to be talk show hosts and comedians that have a regular television show that they produce in their living room.
Yeah.
Right? I think that'll be the next stage of it. But I don't believe that Zoom is a good venue for magic. I mean, I get that you can use the venue. The whole world is your savant. You just drop anything at a screen, or you gesture to the edge of the screen and anybody can load anybody in if you have a cameraman or whatever. I get that there's lots of ways to cheat in Zoom.
Yeah.
But I think the audience gets that too.
And that is, so I did the Chicago Magic Lounge show recently, and afterwards, a couple of friends who had come, they were all in their separate homes. They had come for their friend's birthday. They all stayed in the Zoom and didn't know that we could hear them. So they're all just like talking to each other. And of course, then they start talking about the show. So as a performer, I'm like, well, I'm going to listen in because I'm probably going to learn something that they either really liked or didn't like about my set. Yeah. So this is great. I'm so excited. And the one thing they said, they really liked the show. They were all thankful to be able to see some level of entertainment. But they mentioned, oh, well, we've been to the Chicago Lounge in person and it's way better than this. I mean, like way better. It can't even compare. And someone said, well, there is a pandemic. So I'm sure they're doing their best. And they were like, yeah, it's just it doesn't compare to being able to see magic live. And it's like, yeah, well, because
there's just too many variables. You know, my finger went to the edge of the screen. Anybody could put anything in my finger at the edge of the screen, right?
Correct.
You could drop anything out and you can't see well. No matter how well you can see, you can't see well. You know, if I did a Zoom show, I'd do one interactive piece. I'd say, wait a minute, let me go get my quick change costume. I'd go like this. I'd turn on a video. I'd let the video play for 10 minutes and I'd come back on and say, what'd you think? I mean, why wouldn't you? You'd have a well-produced right. video. Nobody needs to see me execute my routine online. I don't know.
Yeah. You know. Yeah. No, I'm with you because I think sometimes if you do even just a live show, people will be like, oh, are you using your phone for that? Well, clearly it's about your phone. And now it's all over a screen, so I could be doing anything. The other thing that I'm not enjoying about watching Zoom shows is that some performers are calling them live shows, but they're pre-recorded.
Oh, really?
I don't like it.
I haven't watched anybody do any Zoom show at all. Because
great news.
If I don't come up with my own material, it's not going to be interesting. And I sure don't want to draw from other people's material. I'm always very careful not to expose myself. Like, I don't watch every magic show on TV. I don't expose myself to magic because if I come up with an idea and somebody else is doing it, I don't want to know about it.
Yeah.
Right? Because then it's mine. And so I haven't watched any. I'm told that I should, but I'm not motivated.
I mean, I think you've done fine without it.
Well, I have investments and I'm old. But so I get why you would do it if you need to make a living and you want to stay and work. But, it looks ambitious and tiring.
Yeah.
Maybe it's fun. I don't know. Do you know people that like it?
No.
Even the people that are super successful at it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that they aren't out there, but they're just not – people aren't passionate about it. You're just morphing to the necessity of the times. So that's kind of what I feel like I'm doing is I'm morphing to it, but comparatively, I'm not getting anything – besides a check, I'm not getting anything to satisfy my happiness by doing a Zoom show. So that's why I'm not intensely marketing them. But I think you're smart not watching them. I think I've watched too many.
I haven't watched any. Thinking that if I'm going to do it, whatever I come up with will come out of my head and not be a carbon copy of something else. I mean, I assume that everybody drops things off screen now and everybody puts their hand to the edge of the screen and gets things loaded in or not loaded in by an accomplice. Yeah. I assume that that's a standard. But after that, who knows? And I assume that anything that works at home is mathematical. And I think that it's very hard to not hide that from an audience. I don't know. Who knows?
Yeah. So let's take a slight step backwards pre-pandemic, because we usually break the episodes down into your career, your general work right now. And then also, of course, because it's Shazam, we'll talk a little bit about gender-based information, stuff that you've learned, would like to share with the world. So let's go with the career first. Okay. So I'm going to ask you the stupid question, but it's a good kicking off point. What was that beginning like for you, for your start in a career in magic?
I was 10. I was in math club, which means you do mental calculation and you can't write it down and you can't use your fingers. And so I mentally calculated everything. I remember we saw a film about getting your period and it was 4 days a month. And I thought, oh my God, I'm going to have my period more days than I'm in school. And that was the first major calculation that was shocking to me, that I'd spend more time dealing with that than I would actually sitting in the classroom. I'm happy to know that both are past in my life, I'm happy to say. But I instantly calculated anything I could think of, because it was my sport. So I read an article in American Girl magazine because I was a Girl Scout, and it said, if you are 10 years old and you are reading this article and you want to go to university, it'll cost you $40,000. And I thought, minimum wage is $2.20. I have to sleep and go to school. That gives me 8 hours to work at 2:20. There's not enough time between this moment and when I turn 18 to actually make enough money to go to college. I got to start a business because in Texas, you couldn't work till you were 15. And I thought, I'll put clown makeup on and no one will know that I'm not 15. Of course, I looked like I was 8, right? I was 10. And my mother had a magic set when she was a kid. And so she had given me a magic set. So I'd had a magic set and I had done a little magic along the way, but I wasn't serious about it. But I was serious about going to university. And I thought, oh, okay, I'll do a magic show at birthday parties, just like Ickle Pickle from St. Louis did a magic show at my birthday party. So I framed my performance basically around Ickle Pickle. There were prizes and we went on a magical journey together and blah, blah, blah. And I just started doing it. And by the time I was 15, I'd bought my first house. I'd done so many magic shows. I think I did 1,000 magic shows between the ages of 12 and 15 that I thought, okay, my parents were like, you have enough money to buy a house. I do. Okay. So I put a deposit down and I became a landlord at 15. And I had no interest in being a magician professionally. I was just did a birthday party thing and it went great. And I did dozens of birthday parties. And I had to keep changing my material because I was only doing magic in my little suburban community. And I had the same kids 10 or 20 times a year. So I had to come up with some new tricks every time, right? So I went through all the possible easy material that you could find in the library books. And then some boy took me on a date, Andy Ward, who was 2 years younger. So it was a big scandal. I had to drive to Houlihan's and Charles Green was there. And Charles Green did some magic, put the pack of cards on the table. And I thought, oh, well, it's a rough, smooth deck. I know those. And I put my pinky on the deck and I slid it an inch to the right to check the rough, smooth card. And it wasn't a rough deck. And I realized how badly he fooled me. And I called him up and started lessons the next week. And he taught me a double undercut and a double lift. And to this day, a double undercut and a double lift is my best trick. I mean, there's some nuances to it. There might be a classic added and this or that. But in the end, it's my best trick. But it was Charles Green showing me that trick. And that moment when I switched my pinky, I knew that inch of my finger, by the time I finished that ink, that I'd be a professional magician my whole life. That one little inch. I was like, oh, yeah, this is what I'm going to do. And then I decided to go to a super expensive university because I thought if I can afford this university, it'll make me stop doing kids shows and start doing stand up. And if I can afford this university, it's so expensive, then I can probably afford life. And so I went to a really expensive private school to have the pressure of getting enough gigs because getting me out the door and doing the things I was afraid of was easy when I was going to be kicked out of college because I couldn't pay the bill. You know, when you're hungry, you can do amazing things. And once you're not hungry anymore, it's like, nah, I'm not going to try that hard, which is probably why I don't have a Skype show or a Zoom show or an internet show. Well, I mean, you know, if I was hungry, I'd be all over it, right? Anyway, so that's how it started. And then it evolved. But I had no intention. I think I was about 17 and I'd been a professional birthday party entertainer for 6 or 7 years by then. And that's when the bug hit me right before college. And then I had no intention of being a magician either until I was maybe junior year of college. And I realized maybe I didn't have to get a job. I was thinking about going into sales and selling Lear jets because one of my college roommates was Jill Lear. And, you know, one sale was like 100, 200 grand, but I didn't do it.
Why didn't you do it?
Because I found out about trade shows and Paul Gerger sat me down and said, you know, you could do sleight of hand and make a real living. And I started doing these trade shows and I was being paid so much money at those trade shows that it was crazy. Most of my life, I worked maybe 20 days a year.
Wow.
Yeah. And that covered my bills and gave me enough to invest. But frugal is my hobby. That's helpful. I'm extremely frugal. I sleep on the floor of airports. I clip coupons. I always use free boxes. I shop at thrift stores. Even now, I have no interest. Nothing I could possibly own is more interesting or impressive than my very existence. So I have no attachment to showing anybody anything with regard to look at the pretty things that I own. And I'd be perfectly happy living in a van. I had a homeless boyfriend in my 30s and he wouldn't move in my apartment and I would not move into the woods with him. So we moved into a van together as a compromise. So I lived in a van for a year and I loved it. It was really funny. I'd do these gigs. I'd go to the Ritz. I'd get paid a couple of grand to do an hour. Then I'd fly back to wherever we were, maybe North Carolina or something, and go back to a tramp camp and start cooking my things over the fire until my next gig. It was a very interesting time in my life.
I love, because if you said, oh, I went to the Ritz and did a trade show and made a couple of grand, the next thing you would expect is, oh yeah, I did not go back to my van.
Like, no, that right, is- it was this beautiful van and I loved it. So to be honest with you, staying in a hotel room, it doesn't feel nearly as safe to me as sleeping in a vehicle that I own that's tricked out, because all you have to do is get in and turn the key and drive away. And lots of people have keys to your hotel room. I've had problems with that before lots of times, right? And nobody has keys to your van. So it was really interesting, though, because in my 20s, I was so focused on my career and trade shows and things that I missed your early 20s fooling around doing stuff. So I kind of did it in my mid-30s.
I think that's the right thing to do. Also, now I never want to stay in another hotel. I don't want to be
there. Well, I've noticed, first of all, if you're in a hotel room by yourself and the artwork is the same as the last place and all that stuff, you can hear the trucks go by on the highway. If you can hear the trucks makes this sound and it goes, "You're lonely. You're lonely."
But it's so true. One thing that people don't understand about doing a show is, like, you do a show and it's a corporate event. You do the show. Everyone loves you. Everyone's talking to you afterwards. And then you have to pack up all your stuff and you go to the parking garage or you go to your hotel.
All by yourself, loading your crap out, and it's heavy. Yeah.
Yep.
Anticlimactic for sure.
Yeah, but also kind of lovely. It's weird. It's a weird career we have.
Well, once you get used to it, I mean, all my other friends were like, I only have carry-on. And I would always, but you didn't used to have paper luggage, right? I'd bring two suitcases with my arts and crafts and all the books I was doing. And if I happened to touch it, I touched it. But I wasn't going to stop my life for my gig. So I'd bring a box of my own personal entertainment with me everywhere, because it was $2 to pay the porter and the luggage was free. And I was perfectly happy to take that extra 20 minutes at the gate to get my luggage. But most of my other friends were like, I only have a carry-on, look at me. And I'm like, yeah, but all you do is go out and drink at night. So
it's yep. Like, yeah.
But I also was very anti-schmooze my client. A lot of my friends in the corporate world would schmooze and schmooze and schmooze to get work and become friends with their clients, right? And I never did that. If somebody happened to become my friend, great. But I never had an unnatural friendship and I never spent any time. If they like my work, great. That everybody who hired me always hired me for years.
Yeah.
So I never had to.
Were you more of just like, I'm just going to let the work speak for itself, the end?
Well, you know, I marketed myself in the beginning. I got good marketing materials, but work gets work, period. You know, you can market the heck out of things, but if you do a show, you get more gigs. So I never had any trouble getting work. And I always had a policy that I'd double my fees. I think I started out, a lot of magicians at the time were charging about 800 or 1,000 bucks a day. And there was this company called Live Marketing that brought actors in to do a skit. And they were charging 5,000 a day. And I thought, we're better than them. Those stupid actors with their earphones are boring. But the company's been hustled because they've had a couple of meetings. There's a staff and they think this is the price of things. So I'm just going to go ahead and charge 5,000 a day too. See if it works. Right. So I upped my fee and all the other magicians were like, what are you doing? And I'm like, well, if Live Marketing can get it, then people have the budget. And it turned out people would call other magicians and they'd call me. And since I was charging three or four times as much, I must be the best. And it was never the booker's wallet. It was the booker's neck on the line. So, of course, they bought the best.
Right.
And then the Wall Street Journal did an article on me and it said that I bring in 10 times as many leads as a standard trade show display, and that the company that hired me six times a year and they paid me 30 grand a trade show. And so from that point on, everybody who called was expecting to pay me 5 or 10 grand a day. And it was easy. And I went on a vacation to Turkey. I had a boyfriend get married. He was a really sweet boyfriend and I knew I wasn't going to marry him. And we broke up and he met this girl and got married right away. And I didn't want to mess up his wedding. So I left the country. And I took a vacation to Turkey for a month. It was in a time where making a phone call from a place like Turkey took days. So I knew I couldn't bug him and I wanted to give him his space to live his life. And I wasn't sure I could do that. So I went away and I was in Turkey and I was having a great wild time because I could obviously travel by myself comfortably. And every about 2 weeks, I'd check into a Western hotel and there'd be a bus tour of tourists in their 50s and 60s. And I'd tell them about running away with the Bedouin or riding a llama or finding the secret cave or whatever crazy stuff I'd get into. Because once you make a coin disappear, everybody wants you in their life, right? So yep. It was obvious to me that these tourists who were on these tour buses had waited their whole lives to travel. And the best part of their vacation was meeting me. And I thought, if I'm the most interesting part of their vacation, then there are only three things in life that have value: time, money, and youth. And most people, when they're young, have lots of time, but no money. If they're young and they have money, they have no time. But you cannot get back youth. So I thought, I'm going to spend my youth and I'm going to limit myself to working 20 to 30 days a year tops so that I enjoy this fantastic time of being in my 20s and 30s. And I'll just work forever instead of deciding to retire at 55 or whatever it is. And it turns out that everything worked out just fine. But I was very serious about not working more than I needed to work to save whatever I decided was the right amount to save for investments and blah, blah, blah. And it was always 20 or 30 days a year. So I never worked more than 20 or 30 days a year unless it was like a pet project. Like I once did a season in Teatro Zanzani. Well, actually, it was called Palazzo in Europe, which was a mm-hmm. Spiegel tent. And that was 4 months of work. And I only did it because I wanted to work with Russians. Because at the time, I was about my late 30s, and all the Russians who had trained before Perestroika, which was when training in communist countries was intense, were all about to graduate from the circus scene. And I wanted to find out what they learned if they had a lifetime of training. So I worked with a bunch of Russians, and it was amazing. I worked with Voronin and Svetlana. They were my access to this thing because I'd helped them come to America. And I told them I was bored with my work. And so they said, oh, come with us and you'll be in our show. So I went, and they would make me stand there and count 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, as I would watch the acts. And the thing was, I had just come from a show in Chicago and I'd gotten a standing ovation. I flew from Chicago to Vienna to be in this circus performance. And I was terrible. I was the most amateur, most immature, most undeveloped artist in the group, period. And yet none of them had ever made more than $1,000 a week or something, right? So I was paid 10 times them. And in my stand-up comedy American style, I was a pro. But if I was in the circus environment as just a straight variety artist, I was terrible. So counting was really interesting because they wanted me to understand the difference between rhythm and tempo. And it was true that a bad act did something on 1, 2, 3, and 4. They picked up the candle, they walked across the room, they put it in the bag, and they smiled. A good act did something on 2 and 4. They picked up the candle, and they put it in the bag. And a great act did something on 4. They took their absolute time getting to 4. They used distinct and absolute motion. Nothing they did was unmotivated. Nothing they did was extra, and everything was hyper-focused by the use of pantomime, timing, voice, and the pause. And it was really interesting to count. And true, this was before we had cell phones and internet and before attention spans went away. So probably it's a different story now, but I came home from that, and I was such a better entertainer after that. Mm. It made such a difference.
What were some of those differences that you shifted? My thought would be their acts were very musical and often silent, and you're doing more stand-up comedy-based. So what kind of things did you shift knowing in order to be a great act, it needs to be on 4?
Well, I didn't talk as much. I used to think that filling the air with chaos, or as Arsène would say, diarrhea of the mouth, was more interesting than silence. But as it turns out, the pause is interesting. Did you feel that build up?
I did. And I was like, are you
four?
You're there. Oh, you're there. Yeah.
As it turns out, 2, 3, 4. The pause is interesting. So there were a lot of things it taught me. It taught me things about costume. It taught me about timing, lighting, but mostly tempo and rhythm, right? Mm. And making decisions about tempo and rhythm. Because as it turns out, and you can read this in any acting book, a low status character moves quickly and a high status character moves slowly. You come out on stage really quick and you go to the edge of the stage and you try to go over, you're a pure amateur. You glide out on the stage, taking your time. You look out at the audience left to right, and then you crack a smile. You're saying, you're acceptable and I'm glad you're here, versus like me, like me, like me, right? Those sort of things I've got to hang up.
I've never I've understood the high status versus low status, but I think the idea of this glide, this like, you bought a ticket. So I'm going to make sure, oh no, I do approve of you. Okay, now we can get into it. That's such an interesting mindset that like, because I'm very chaotic just as a human. You could see how much I'm moving in this Zoom. Now I have to look at video and go, oh shoot, well, where's the four?
And it's interesting, right? And if 1 to 4, you're just waving your arms in the air, it's fine. As long as when you stop, you do something, right?
But
it's the difference between here I am and there you are.
Mm.
Any performer who walks out and says, here I am, is never going to be anything but be. But there you are, and I'm really glad you're here, versus, ah, you're here, and it's me, you're here to look at me. It's a whole different thing than, ah, you came. How great. I'm so glad. Such a different attitude, right?
Mm. Do you think that made also a difference in your quality of trade show work as well?
No, I can't say that, because that was about when I decided, okay, I'm done with trade shows. I have enough money. I was probably 35 when I decided. I bought a mall when I was 35, or a quarter interest in a mall.
Yeah, of course.
I'd save my pennies. And I knew that I was going to invest in some real estate. So for about 15 years, I owned a mall, and it gave me $200 a day, which is great. It's just what I needed. It was plenty to live on. I had plenty extra, but I knew that I had enough money at that point where I didn't have to work for money. So I shifted out of trade shows, because as interesting as trade shows were, because you could make such a fortune, and you know, it was fun to be all my, I happen to work only in .com and only in high tech, very few other gigs. I got occasional other gig out of it, but mostly that. So it was really interesting to be part of the, when I started working in computers, people didn't have home computers. I did. When .com became the internet, I was working on wide area and local area networks, which were the precursor to the internet. I met all the players in the scene of technology that were super interesting. And because I had learned about all these products to present them, I could talk the talk and walk the walk. So it was a really interesting time to be part of the high tech world. And I was really the darling of high tech. Some article called me that. I'd walk through any high tech event and everybody would say, oh, Lisa, there's Lisa. Oh, hey, Lisa, there's the magician, right? Everybody from the heavies in the industry to anybody who worked in the industry. And I was quite famous in that industry. So it was fun, right? It was fun to be part of the cutting edge of technology. And then it wasn't. And then it was like, okay, I've had enough. It's fine.
What do you think makes a good trade show performer?
I think it's a big mistake for trade show performers to stand behind the counter. And
I
like
think that too.
With a close-up pad. So I moved my counter to the left. And I made it a pillar so I could put things on the table, but I wasn't standing behind it. Yeah. And then I put 5 chairs in front of me, just 5, so that the first row was sitting down. Because if you have a counter and you only have 5 people standing in front of you, then 5 people get behind them. You can only go 15 people thick and nobody can see. But if you put down 5 chairs, then that establishes a line of how far back the audience has to stand. And behind 5 chairs can stand 15 people. So the first row is 5, the second row is 15, and the third row is 30. Suddenly you're up to a 50-person crowd versus a little pedestal. It's hard to get bigger than a 25-person crowd because people can't see you. So I think that the blocking of a trade show is important. I think it's really important to repeat the message of whatever the company is every 3 minutes in the show versus you have to stay for the whole show to get the whole message. If you get their attention for 3 minutes, they can self-qualify and say, I need that product or I don't. But it boils down to, if your company spends $300,000 on their booth and they walk away with 1,000 leads, it's fine. They spend $330,000 on their booth because they gave you an extra 30 and they walk away with 10,000 leads and those leads already know they want the product. They're happy to give you 30,000 every time, right? I mean, I don't know. They say trade shows have changed and prices are different now and people don't make as much money, but I don't believe that. And I used to tell the other entertainers, you got to charge more, and they were chicken. And I'd be like, you guys don't understand. You're crazy. But the other guys, I'm like, you're not competing against the other magicians. You're competing against the damn popcorn machine. And that gets $1,000 a day.
Mm.
So you should charge more. And then I had a thing where I'd book my shows. And then I'd call my clients at the end of the year. And I'd say, listen, I want to book for next. Do you want to book me for next year? Right now, I'm booking at this year's prices. But as soon as I book my first 10 days, I'm doubling my fees. So you better let me know by the end of the year if you want to book me again. And some of them did and some of them didn't. And sure enough, if they called me late, they like, I know your price is double, but the boss didn't approve it till now. We still want you. And I found out, oh my God, they'll still pay me? Okay. So I think trade shows is a great way to make a living. It's really fun. And there's nuances to getting people to stop and to delivering a good show and to creating a good product and all that stuff that's part of sales. And that's a different conversation altogether.
Mm. So when you had your trade show, was it a more of like a plug and play where you had sort of the same routines that you plugged in the message, or were you doing
together and say, there's no place like, and then I'd turn and look at the sign of the company. So I got it right. Everybody would laugh knowing that I was looking at the sign of the company. And then I'd repeat it three times. Sure. I had certain times where, I can't tell you because, you know, the first rule in magic is never tell your secret. That's why you don't see very many women magicians. Ha 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 ha. But the big secret is Charlie can sell you a blah, 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 blah. So there were plug and play places in my routines that I knew that I could get certain things out. But also, if there was a bottle, I remember doing, Peter Studebaker was one of my mentors, and he insisted that I do pure sleight of hand without any gimmicks for a couple of years, which was fine. Mm. I'm really glad I got my chops. He used to say, you can drive a truck through that break. And I found out that somebody else said it to him first.
Yeah, but sure.
Nonetheless, I'd hustle and I'd do my one-handed bottom and I'd do my pharaoh and I'd do my this and that and my show was great. And this company was doing something where it stopped the bottleneck in your network, was the scientific term. So of course, I got myself a Nielsen bottle. I replaced the top with a piece of glass so I could ring it so it would sound like glass, and I vanished it at the end of the show to get rid of your network bottleneck. Work my ass off with sleight of hand, then stick the rubber thing in the bag and vanish it. Everybody asked about the damn bottle. Nobody cared about the card tricks, which were great, according to me, which was my wake-up call that any gimmick, it didn't matter how you got it done, the simplest, best way was to do it. So I did trade shows from about 23 years old to about 30 years old. And then I tapered down on trade shows. And in my mid-20s, around 28, I decided I wanted to do 7 years of everything. I did 7 years of birthday parties, 7 years of walk around and stand up at restaurants. Then I did 7 years of trade shows, which is basically stand up. And then I wanted to get into illusions. So around 26 or 27, I started incorporating illusions into my trade show booth. So I got an origami box and I got a zigzag and I got anything that could be done surrounded. So I could start working out the routines at the trade show because I already had the gig, so they would be good. And then I transferred over to meetings, which made me aware that it was way more fun not to have to hustle your crowd. And then Ricky J talked me into starting to four-wall shows. And four-walling means you rent the theater, you sell the ticket, you do the show, you clean up the room, you give a commission to the guy who sells popcorn, and you walk away and you keep all the money or you lose all the money. And I was like, why should I do that? He said, because the minute you start doing shows where people have paid for a ticket, that means they went home, they took a shower, they dressed up for you. And so there are many hours of anticipation of having a good time with the magic. So you're thinking about magic. You get there and you're ready to enjoy it. If you just happen to be at a meeting or you just happen to be at a party, then it just happened to you and it's fine. But there was no anticipation of the audience and they haven't collectively said, I'm going to spend money to see this. So the audience is so different when they're eager to see you, right? And especially if they paid a high price. And he was right. When an audience pays a lot of money to see you or has invested in the time, they're eager to have a good time and you can show them a good time.
Oh, it's so true. One of the things I hate about strolling magic is the fact that you have to almost convince people to want to be entertained.
It's a hustle.
Yeah. I'm over it. Four-walling. It's great.
Well, and it's interesting too, because if you get paid $1,000 for a show, they send a limo. If you get paid $100 for the same show, somebody tries to touch your butt.
I'm laughing because it's true.
I know. Well, because you're perceived value.
Right.
Right. And I'd like to make a statement about that to the magicians that are listening with regard to sexual harassment. I think a lot of magicians don't understand that when you bring up a sex joke, when you insert your penis into the conversation, when the punchline is my erection or the punchline is she had sex, you are elevating men to studs and you are devaluating women to sluts. And while there is no such thing as a slut, and slut shaming is a Victorian idea that says virginity is praised because then we can control women because, you know, marriage was invented 5,000 years ago when property was invented. And suddenly virginity became a thing because instead of the village raising your children, it was private and you had to know who your kid was so they could inherit. So then you had to squash any promiscuousness in your female because she could go out and get a seed from someone else and you'd spend your resources on that child. So suddenly sexuality became a way to judge women. And I can't tell you how many, and you guys all complain about how hard it is, and I laugh at you. I laugh at you. There were two other women in magic when I got started, and both were married to magicians, so they were protected. I laugh at you how hard it was those days. But men don't understand that the only appropriate time to bring up a sex joke is either if you are naked with another person, then a sex joke is funny, or you're in an environment where sex is the agenda. If you're working in a nightclub where men are trying to pick up women and women are trying to pick up men, then making jokes about sexuality and sex, as long as they're not sex shaming or condemning, is appropriate. But in no other arena in our culture is that appropriate. You go to Europe, it's fine. They're not hung up about sex. They don't judge people about the amount of sex that they have. But you can read the classic books. In your generation, it's different. But the classic sales books of the 80s and 90s would say, as a woman, and this was so true for me too, the men in your business will support you until you succeed. Then they will immediately start disparaging you for your sex life. And that's what happened to me. Everybody was really supportive and really wanted me to get work and become a professional when I was young, because it'd been a really long time since a thinking woman had showed up on the scene and had her own stuff. And I'd performed for like 7 years before I met other magicians. So my character was well established and I knew what I was doing. And so they were all really encouraging. And then when I started really succeeding, they were so mad that they would start to talk about who I slept with as if that debased me. In fact, it's so backwards in the magic world that I never dated magicians because it was just too hard. At first, I dated a couple of magicians, and the assumption that anything that I did came from my boyfriend came with apologies. I remember Tommy Wonder came to my house once, and I was showing him some things I had worked on and some inventions that were failing and that I needed an idea with. And I was just going through all my stuff, showing him everything I'd tried and stuff. And he stopped and he looked at me and he said, "I'm so sorry. We've been friends for almost 10 years, and I always thought somebody taught you everything you know. I apologize. I don't know why I would think that you wouldn't have invented your stuff yourself. I don't know why I thought you learned it from some guy. I'm sorry." And they were all like that. And I started dating Raphael Benatar when I was 32. We went to FISM together. I was booked at FISM in Dresden. And we met maybe 200 people in common that we knew in common. At the end of the day, we crawled into bed and he said, "I know who your magician boyfriends are." And I said, "Who?" And he named all three of them. And I'm like, "We met 200 people today. How do you know that those were my boyfriends?" And he said, "Because they're the only ones that didn't make the joke, 'Yeah, I fucked her. I slept with her.' Every old man said, 'She used to be my girlfriend.' 'Oh yeah, we fucked,' said the young man. 'Oh, she's a sexy woman. We had our time together, you know.' They all made the same joke, except the three men that I had actually been with. Hundreds of men made that joke, thinking it was funny. Why? I don't understand the mentality of men, but I do know that women that write biographies of famous men who've done great things, all they want to talk about is all the women that they had sex with. Look at Gayton, who was one of my boyfriends. You look at his stupid life story and there's a picture of all his girlfriends. I'm like, 'Gayton, you put me in your damn book.' And he's like, 'I thought it would be an honor.' And I'm like, 'No, I don't want to be on the list of women that you've conquered. No one knows that.' And I look at him, and then somebody walks up to us at the convention and they go, 'Oh yes, Gayton, you're hanging out with your old girlfriend. That's nice.'" So I don't know. You know, what would it be like if you had an appendage? Imagine if your elbow had a life of its own and it led you across the room and made you lie. I can't imagine what it's like to have one of those dingle dangles, but it certainly makes for bad decisions.
My elbow. Yeah, I mean, I kind of experienced something rather similar, which is as soon as I started actually having a career and people paying attention to me, one, everyone attributed my success to Harrison, which, I mean, of course, he's very influential and supportive, but I wouldn't say that he created or taught me everything. Right. And two, I even just the other day found out, oh, this person is going on and on still about how you guys slept together. And I'm like, we didn't though. What? What's happening? And it's just, I just saw Kayla, her thing on Fula. She's great. Oh, well, I conquered her. What's happening? Why is this still a thing?
I don't know. We're not men. It must be biological because, you know, I mean, it's very confusing because we're supposed to be offended when they sexualize us. But that is only true if you buy into the fact that there is shame in sex and that virginity has a virtue, or there's something virtuous about not enjoying sex. if men would stop slut shaming us, then we wouldn't hold it back. And if men would give us equal pay, we wouldn't have to barter our sexuality to have security. If we had all the money that we needed and we had equal jobs and equal pay around the world, we'd put out all the time because it's fun and it feels good. But we got to hold back so that we can secure security, especially in other cultures that are not as modern as ours. Sure. I don't know how men miss the idea that if you don't give us good jobs and we're dependent on you, we're not going to enjoy sex with everybody we meet. We're going to save it up so that we can conquer and grab that guy so that we can eat, because eating is more important than sex. But I don't know where they got there. But anyway, that's that. So you men, stop it.
You heard it here.
And now in my 50s and 60s, I cannot tell you how many magicians have called me up and apologized for things that they did that I didn't know about.
Wow.
And then shortly dropped dead. So they're dying of cancer, they're dying of this, or they're dying of that, and they want to purge, and they're really sorry about it. So now when I get somebody writing to me and apologizing for being a shit in the 70s or the 80s, I'm like, oh God, the chemo isn't working.
I mean, why? Do we have to wait until the chemo's not working? Just...
Who knows? I mean, your generation is different.
Do it.
Your generation, yeah. A woman who isn't sexually active, it's freaky. And in my generation, I was your generation in my generation, which was weird. And now you guys are all what we were. I mean, it used to be that when I grew up, I actually heard good girls don't have sex. Nice girls don't have sex. If you enjoy sex with someone who has not purchased you by contract, which is marriage, then you have low self-esteem. Instead of, if you enjoy sex, it's because it feels good. Those were like, low self-esteem? What? I'm sorry, you mean enjoying caressing means that I'm insecure? I don't think so. So those were givens. You have low self-esteem if you have sex. You are less valued if you've had sex with X number of partners, right? And men, I don't know if men still do it, but men were retroactively jealous. You'd meet a man, you'd get together with him, and he'd find out that you'd had three or four boyfriends before him, and he would be so mad. I don't know if they still do that.
No, I mean, maybe, but not in my experience.
Yeah, no, you guys are lucky. You're so lucky that we cleared the road for you.
I mean, yeah, certainly you have paved a way for like me to do trade shows and things, but I'm just thinking specifically, like, I think part of the reason I got to do trade shows is because Lisa Mena got to do trade shows.
No, it's not. That's not true. I didn't pave the way for you to do trade shows. Trade shows have always been right for any woman. Any woman who says women aren't getting enough work, women aren't getting enough exposure, you don't put enough women on the cover, whatever it is, those are women who have no talent.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's much easier to get a job at a trade show as a woman magician than as a man, because still the world is skewed that most of the people who attend conferences and travel for work are men. Not as many as it used to, but more men who are decision makers will stop and watch a woman perform than watch a man. It's easier for women. Anybody who is banging the drum of equality in magic is doing it because they don't have a good act. Because if you have just a decent act, just an okay, not amateur act, you get booked at every magic convention there is. I don't know if you people are aware. I mean, I guess it's obvious to the professionals. If you're working magic conventions, it's because you're not working in life.
Yeah.
You know, if you're a magic star, it means you're not really actually working, because the real pros are out there working, doing their thing, right? But still, in the world, you're not going to get booked more because you're a woman necessarily, but it's easier as a woman. It's definitely easier to do trade shows as a woman. But in the magic world, it's super easy. I mean, I know some really marginal soft acts that were permitted to succeed in our world because they were produced by someone who was not a man. Whereas if you're a man, you got so much competition that you've got to really find a way to be unique and stand out. Whereas as a woman, you know, you can pick up almost any feminine prop and nobody's done a trick with it yet. It could be your own, right?
I love that. I think that's great advice. So Mama Mena, how did Mama Mena develop? Where did you go, okay, I want to now play this?
Oh, really? I decided in my 20s.
Oh, really?
I said as soon as I got old enough, I'm going to do this. Well,
I love her.
My idea was to retire at 35. I'd always planned to retire at 35 because I figured I'd get married and have kids. And I didn't have kids. So that's why I opened Cause to Wonder. But I thought that I'd retire, have kids, and have a second life. So that was always my plan. But I thought after 35, if I continue to perform, as soon as I'm old enough, I'd like to perform as an old woman. And as hip as I was, and as much fun as I was, and as improvising as I was, I didn't get a lot of standing ovations. Mama Mena gets a standing ovation every time she performs. And it's not because I'm better, because Mama Mena only does Lisa Mena's material, steals it all, right? Sure. And she doesn't do it as well because she doesn't work nearly as much as Lisa Mena ever did. And so she's fumbling and she's old. And it's not like you're thinking, oh, that lady's in a wig and she's pretending. People think I'm 78, wow. Right? Yeah. So they give me a standing ovation just for being there. But also, if I say, you are a spoiled brat and you better sit down and shut up, I'm a bitch. But if an old lady says, look at you, you spoiled brat. Oh my God, what kind of papa you have? You sit down, you shut up, you be quiet, you say nothing. It's funny.
Yeah.
And it's not funny if I say it, I'm a bitch. So the permission of an elderly person speaking their mind or making a joke is a different story. But I have to admit, I have to change the name of Mama Mena because people hear and remember Mama Mia.
Oh, interesting.
Even people that love me, even people that know my name well, they say, how's Mama Mia? And it just rolls out their tongue. And obviously, Mama Mia is not something that would be Googleable because of the show.
Right.
So I'd really like to come up with it. If anybody has any suggestions for me, I was thinking Mama Fiasco.
Oh, fun.
But it puts you in the I'm expecting a fiasco category. So
got
there's
you.
No surprise to you. You know, I think there should be a contrary in any character. Like if you play a witch, you should have a problem with giggling, right?
Yeah.
If you play a sophisticated lady, you should burp. Mm. If you play a downtrodden individual, you should be able to waltz.
Mm.
Right? There should always be some kind of a contradictory element in your character.
Yeah. Well, it's also that like high status character, giving them a flaw so that they're relatable.
Right.
Is helpful.
And also having a flaw and the resolution of a tragic flaw is the basis of any good story. Even if it's the minor flaw of I can't find your card.
Right.
Because Mama Mena has Alzheimer's. She keeps having cards picked. She doesn't remember that she's had a card picked and that she hasn't found the other one until the very end of the show. That kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Is there a place, let's just say pre-pandemic and then potentially post-pandemic, where can one see Mama Mena?
If I get booked for a show, I try to do Mama Mena. I don't tell them. I just show up and do Mama Mena, even if they're booking me.
Yeah.
So there's not a place. I don't have a regular performance place and I just happen to get in book shows and do them. But that's I haven't done it a lot. I've done it less than 100 times and I've been doing it for a decade.
Mm, yep. Well, we'll just have to hire Mama Mena for a show. Done.
Yeah, maybe. But I'm not in a big hurry to work. If the environment isn't perfect,
oh, yeah.
I'm not going to do it. And I'm certainly not going to work during the pandemic.
Oh, no. Gosh, no. No, no, no. I love that. That's great. Also talking about current day, I want to talk to you about Cause to Wonder. I love
it. Yeah, Cause to Wonder is pretty neat. That was an accident because I kept having children that didn't breathe. So I had all these tragic fertility stories and I almost had a kid and da, 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 and I was a disaster. And I just had a miscarriage and I was in my house in Canada and Shark Tank or Dragon's Den came through town. It's a show where you pitch an idea and you get an investment. And I hadn't left the house in like a month and I was so downtrodden and so hurt because I'd given birth to a baby that wasn't alive. And I couldn't leave the house. And this thing came through town and I'm like, all right, I'm going to get out of the house. I'm going to go down there and I'm going to come up with some character and I'm going to audition. And I'm going to show off one of my inventions because I've got lots of inventions that I've invented over life. And I'm just going to get on this show, damn it, just to see if I can. So I went down to the little local community center where they were having auditions and my whole little village, and I live in a village of about 8,000 people, and my whole little village shows up and 50 people are trying to get on this TV show and pitch their product or show their ideas. So I signed up last or near the end because I figured everybody else was off work and they needed the space. So I sat there in character all day. And before I went down there, I wasn't planning to do an old lady. My girlfriend came over and I said, I got to do this thing. And I tried on like 8 costumes and I was either going to be a showgirl that was drunk or this, or, and I just kept trying to, and I put this old lady outfit on and I had done an Italian accent in the circus that I was working in Europe because it was right after 9/11. It was about 2004 and America was causing war on the world. And I was trying to do a character, a shoeshine character. And when I would talk to these people, they hated me because I was American. Nothing I could say was funny because they hated America so much. Mm. So I would say, I said, okay, I'll do an Italian accent. I said, okay, sprechen Sie Italiano? And they'd say, no. I'd say, oh, sprechen Sie Inglese? And they'd say, yes. I said, okay, we speak English together. So I would pretend to be an Italian speaking English so we had a mutual language. So I had that in my pocket, which was a well-trotted Italian accent. So I went down there, put on a fat suit, played an Italian character. They didn't hire me. They didn't pick me. But then like 3 weeks later, they called me up and they said, we know who you are. because I pitched the Sneaky Peaky, which was a sticker, which was Fresnel lenses, concentric circles on a sticker. So, you know, you look in it, you can see a wider thing. And I put it on a magazine so you could hold the magazine up and see behind you, or put it on your phone, and it was like a secret sneaky mirror. And it was a lousy product, but I thought it was funny. And I could make them for a penny because I already had a bunch of Fresnel lens things because I used to cover my props in it because it would pick up more light. So the woman says to me, isn't this just a sticker? And I said, no, it's proprietary. I invent when I make my magic trick. And she said, oh, you're the magician. Do a trick. I said, I don't work for free. And I slammed my suitcase and I left. But I left her with a magazine with a little sticker on the corner as a prop to see. You could hold up the magazine and see behind you. And I said, I know it's a good product because kids, when they put them on their notebook, they get their books taken away at school. So it's got to be good. That was part of my pitch, right? But the magazine that I put the sticker on was a mom magazine on which I was on the cover. So this is a glamorous woman in a red dress, you know. So she takes home the magazine. She's bored and she's looking through her stuff and she looks at it and she opens it up and realizes it's a magician's magazine. This is really me. So she calls me up and says, we want you to do corporate events. We want you to pitch corporate events. And I'm like, but I already do corporate events. I already am a corporate magician, and I sure don't need a venture capitalist whose ego is so big that they have to be on TV to finance me. I date venture capitalists. If I want venture capital, I know how to get it. But I do want 8 minutes of Canadian national airtime, and you do want a professional entertainer. So why don't you hire me, and I'll come up with some other product, and I'll pitch it, and we'll see if it works. And I said, okay. So they flew me out to Toronto. And I had like 2 months between that conversation and going to Toronto. So I had to figure out what to do because I thought, okay, I'm retired. I have these investments. I do a little magic for the fun of it, but I won't need to hustle for money anymore. If I'm going to go back to work and actually have to be responsible to somebody, it better be doing something that I truly, deeply believe in and love. So I came up with all these different ideas and I thought about trade shows and different things. And I tried to come up with different businesses. And I found a guy named Larry Brilliant, and he had a bus that would go to rock concerts and test for syphilis in the 70s. Because if you're at a concert, getting tested for syphilis was easy. It was free, and you came back in 10 minutes, and you found out, and if you had it, they gave you the penicillin, and you were cool. Couldn't be easier. So they had a huge impact on STDs, wow. Right? So then they took the bus to Europe, did the same thing, ended up taking the bus to India, and practically eradicated smallpox in India by taking this bus and doing this show. They did this music presentation show, and everybody came out to see the white people in the bus. And it was so impacting, I thought, I'll imitate the bus. I'll take a bus around. I'll do a magic show. And I understood from other travel how impacting it could be. So I pitched the idea of this. And it was a thinly veiled nonprofit. I called it an advertising firm to do interstitial marketing, you know, little videos before whatever, because the internet was new then too. And they didn't go for it. But the character, I played Mama Mena, and the character went over so great that I took it to New York City the next week. And I walked around New York City for a week as Mama Mena. And I'd walk down the street as an old lady. And you know how New York, nobody sees you. They're just going, 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 going. And then I'd do a pratfall. And my pratfall is good. You can't tell that I'm not really tripping. And I wouldn't fall on the ground. I'd just trip up a little bit, right? And the thing is, as Mama Mena, I'd walk down the street and I'd do a little pratfall and everybody would go, oh, and like six people would grab me so I didn't fall over. And I realized in that moment, and then I was in my early 40s at the time, I thought, oh my God, it's like I'm a 2-year-old lost on the street. Everybody's pretending they don't see me, but in their conscience, they're like, there's a little old lady. I hope she's safe. And they were all ready to make sure I was okay. And I thought, oh, isn't that interesting how great people treat you when you're old? And then like I went to a street fair and I'm watching the musician and I'm just dancing a little bit as Mama Mena, of course, kind of a rigid dance, but just a little bit. And people started videoing me because I was an old lady enjoying myself with some joie de vivre for life. And I thought how interesting it is to be treated as an old lady and how I'm not afraid of getting old at all anymore because I realize I'm like a child to people and they want to protect me. And the other thing is Mama Mena carries a cane, right? So I got to go through airports and I got to carry the cane because it doesn't fit my luggage. They scooch you to the front of the freaking line. They drive me to the next, you know, I never order a cart and they show up with a freaking cart. And I don't want to say, look, I'm not old. This is just a prop.
I love it.
Yeah. So Mama Mena was pretty interesting. So anyway, I'd been in Sri Lanka as a child, well, in my teens, and I did a little magic in Sri Lanka and the village loved it. And it went from like six people to like 50 people in a minute. The whole village was there. and they loved me. And I was not a professional magician yet. I was still in college thinking I would probably do trade shows and be a professional magician. I wasn't sure. And they loved me so much that they were glowing. And I thought, I finally got it. I've crossed over it. I've got that it thing. And at the time, I was having trouble getting out of close-up and doing stand-up. I was kind of stinky at stand-up, right? I was hunched over like I was at a table. I didn't have my timing right. I wasn't there yet. And I thought, I've got it. I finally got that thing. They love me. And I had no idea that they thought I was supernatural. And then this woman came up to me. She was my age. She handed me a bundle of rags. And she dropped to the ground and started kissing my feet. And in the bundle of rags was her deformed baby. And she's begging me to fix her baby. And I'm so ashamed because I'm going from thinking, I'm the greatest thing ever. They love me. I'm going to be a star, to, oh my God, I'm a fraud. And it was the first time I'd actually thought I've committed a true sin, right? Mm-hmm. I've actually done something terrible here. And I was so ashamed of the story that I didn't tell anybody about it. If I did, I'd end it with, I told the village that they were lucky that the child was in the village and it would be lucky for the village. And they'd find out the reason when the baby turned 35 so that they would take care of the baby. But I made up that ending. I never said that. But I made it up because I wanted to tell the story of how interesting it was that I could be perceived as a supernatural being just doing tricks. So I realized that the power that one can have if one makes people in the state of deep wonder could probably be turned around. And there are a lot of people that object that say, you're tricking men into not beating their wives. I'm like, yeah, I'm good with that. You know, I mean, well, a supernatural being with a reward for good behavior exists in every culture. Even in Papua New Guinea, that's deeply tribal. They have these huli wigmen that dress up and shake the house if children were misbehaving to frighten them. Yeah, okay, it's your Uncle Charlie, but the kids don't know.
Right?
And, you know, we have heaven, supernatural. You know, the guy did loaves and fishes. If you were really divinely empowered, you would not be turning water to wine. That is definitely a vent planner party trick, right? So he performed for 3.5 years. He had a passable magic act with a message, and it worked. It stuck. And once I started doing it, I started understanding that the state of cognitive dissonance, or the state of not understanding what's going on, primes people with an open mind for learning anything, not just the topic that opened their mind. So I think it's 200 times more effective to learn through play and experimentation than through rote. So if someone tells you something, hardly likely to learn it. But if you discover it through play, it sticks with you forever. So what I do with Cause to Wonder is I go into villages, I gather the village together, I make a couple rocks disappear and do some other magic tricks. And instead of saying abracadabra, I say, if you want to have good luck, don't hit women, or helping women brings good luck, or don't poop in the water supply if you want the village to be lucky, or whatever the ecological or human rights aspect of their culture could evolve and cause less human suffering. Mostly I do women's rights work because that's what people contact me to do. But I also do conservation work and that sort of thing. So the work of presenting a passable magic show with a message is by some people considered to be a charlatan. One of my favorite magicians who I really love says, you're as bad as an evangelical preacher. And I'm like, okay, so I'm not offering a religion. I'm not healing anybody. The same person made a comment. I had a picture of me with a stick on the internet. And he said, are you going to turn it into a snake? And I was doing a balancing trick with the snake, but he was referencing Moses's material because Moses turned the stick into a snake. And I'm like, yeah, isn't it great that he's still getting credit for his work all these years later? And we still say that's Moses's material, but I don't want to steal his material. And the guy was, I think not. So I was like, isn't that interesting that you will acknowledge that staff to snake is Moses's material, but you will not acknowledge the possibility that it was not divinely inspired by a deity. But yet, every religion, do you know that Muhammad split the moon? Muhammad had his own series of tricks. Almost every religion starts with a miracle. And of the 2,400 stories that exist in our Western culture, this does not count Chinese, I don't think, because I got this statistic from the Storytelling Museum in Oxford. But of those stories, 97% feature a supernatural being of some sort. And stories reinforce cultural norms. Even hi, how are you? I'm fine, thank you. How are you? Is a cultural norm story that we reinforce, right? Mm. So the idea that if someone is in the state of wonder when they're experiencing new information makes them learn it so much more quickly or experiment with it. And I think experimenting for cooperation, getting cooperation with women in other ways than violence is valid. I'd like every boy who's ever seen my show to experiment with it. Last year, I spent a couple months in Punjab, India. And while I was there, except for the very last place I stayed, everybody I met in that entire trip had never met a foreigner. Not a black one, not a yellow one, not a red one, not a pink one, not an orange one, not a white one, not anything. They'd only met other Punjab Indian people or people from other places in India, Pakistan, or Bangladesh. So none of them had ever seen a foreigner. And it was really interesting that the power of just being foreign to have people come and gather. So I went around, five different households hosted me. So I'd stay with different families, which meant I had a host that was a local government official. And so I was okayed. And I would do a combination of work. I'd go to all the schools. But if you go to a school show, it's a school presentation.
Mm.
It doesn't have the impact of if you're walking down the street and you run into someone and something magical happens, right? But I went ahead and did a bunch of school shows in this area. And then at the end of the week, my hosts would always want me to go meet all these people and have tea with them so they could take a picture of the foreigner in their house. And I didn't want to be paraded around. And it took me a couple of families to figure out that, no, I'm not going to allow that. I'm not going to have tea at your friend's house because you feel obligated to share your foreign friend. So I'd say, okay, anybody who wants to have a selfie or anything like that, on Friday at the village square, I will do a show for the whole village. So I get to this village square, and I've done that for a couple of weeks, and usually there's 200 or 300 people around the tree or the village square or whatever, and it's a great show. Well, this one I get to, there are 1,500 people, and it is the remotest part of Punjab I've ever been. And in India, most women do not leave the house. They stand on the rooftop and look over. They shout to the ladies across the roof, but if they leave the house, they have a male escort. Until recently, most of the women never showed their face to their father-in-law. They'd hide behind a veil until 20 years ago. So I was in this town called Suriwala. And I did these shows, and I show up for my end of the week thing at the village, and these 1,500 people are there. And they have a little raised area for me to stand on. All the village elders are on seats behind me. In front of me are about 250 children sitting on the ground. Behind them are all the women sitting behind them, and behind them are all the men standing. I take out a stick, and I hold it up, and I go like this, and I make a magic pass over it. And because all the kids had already seen me in school, as soon as I make the magic pass, because I make the kids repeat the words over and over and over for the magic to happen, all the kids shout, Changi kismat chande o ortanu nakuto namaro, which means if you want to have good luck, don't beat women and don't kill women, because a lot of people are killed because they're not satisfactory wives. So all the children shout this as soon as I wave my hand or didn't even introduce a phrase. All of the women full smile with their teeth. And a tooth smile is something you try to hide in public because it's too aggressive. It's too much, right? All the women, bright smiles. Oh my God, the children just said, what? And all the men either smiled ear to ear or they looked terrified. Because even at 30, I know that you look down at 16 and 17 year olds who are misbehaving and you're like, holy cow, this is a mob of kids. There's nothing I can do about this. This is the next generation. You saw terror run through the mind of those men in the village. You saw it because there's no way you can take back the phrase, if you hit or hurt women, you're going to have bad luck. If you kill women, you're going to have bad luck. And everybody in the village said it, repeated it. They said it many times, and the children are already down by it. And I also, one of the things I did years ago was hire a scientist to do a measures and impact report. So I did a series of shows in Mozambique. Then a couple of years later, I sent a scientist to go back and go to all the villages I went to, find out who remembered me, if they remembered the words I said, if they remember the tricks I did, if they thought of me as a witch or a clown, if they knew the slogan. So we did a big survey about what they thought. And everybody said, oh, we knew she was a clown and we knew it wasn't black magic. And all the elders remembered all the tricks, but not necessarily the song. And all the younger people remembered the song exactly because elders had heard so many songs, but the tricks were so unique. But one of the elders who said, oh, no, we knew it was for fun. We knew it wasn't black magic because they certainly believe in black magic. In this particular show, it was the poop show. I was teaching people not to poop in the water supply. It was a complicated show, but part of it was I'd hold up a glass of water underneath a baby. A poop would appear in the glass of water. I'd say, oh, the baby pooped in the water. Oh, no. You know what happens when somebody poops in the water? And then using a thimble move, I'd go around and take poop out of behind people's ears, right? So I'd collect all this poop, and then I'd do poop from mouth, which is falls from mouth. And endless poop would come out of my mouth as I drank the water, which is totally disgusting. I can't tell you, as that poop slowly comes out between your lips, horrifying.
No.
And repeatedly, right? So then I'd take the pile of poop and I'd bury it and flowers would grow to teach them about dry composting. So the old woman said, well, I gave my grandson a bath that morning. I don't know how poop got behind her ear. But since that woman touched him, I watched him very closely for a year, but nothing happened. So I know he's okay. So the same woman who said, no, I knew it was clown, not black magic, didn't really believe that. right? It was very interesting. We had like a, I think we had 104% retention, which meant 2 years after the events, 4% more people knew the slogan than actually saw the show. And in the local villages that were bordering these villages that were not on the lake, but on the river, instead of the slogan being "a clean lake is a happy life," the slogan had evolved to "a clean river is a happy life."
Mm.
So it was all very interesting.
Oh, I love it. I love this all so much. The Let's Make a Vanish segment is brought to you by the LA Collusion. So before we begin this week's Let's Make It Vanish, I wanted to mention that a better name has come across my plate for the Barehanded Matrix, which is just an awful name anyway. I shouldn't have made it up. It was terrible. But that was the only thing I could come up with, and now there's something better. So according to our unofficial Shazam magic historian, that's right, Mark D'Souza, the original title of this effect was Migrating Coins, and then published as Sympathetic Coins in Art of Magic in 1909. So I'm really enjoying the Migrating Coins as the new name of the effect, and I think that really nails it. So that's what I'm going with. Boom. Okay, let's get to this week. She's one of the guys. I've been told it. Oh, it's like you're one of the guys, Kayla. This is so cool. You're one of the guys. My friends have been told it. My friends say that about themselves. I'm like one of the guys. And it all just seems like a really great thing. She can hang with the guys, which means she's cool. And in magic, it feels like that's what we completely want to do. We want to be a part of the group, which is mainly men. And when you boil this phrase down, it's more like guys are cool and fun to hang with, but don't be a girl because they're no fun. You got to be like one of the guys. And then we like the women that are more like the guys. So for anyone that is more, quote, feminine, a more feminine person, this feels a bit alienating. If you're not one of the guys, so then you can't hang. Does that mean if you have any range of emotion, you can't hang? Does that mean you can't talk about certain subjects? Oh, okay, you can't hang. It's just one of those phrases that feels like it's a compliment, but can actually have a very different meaning than we really intend. A potentially better compliment is just, we enjoy hanging out with you, or it was really fun that you joined our group. It therefore has no attached gender, expectations due to gender, all of that. And I hear this phrase so much in magic, and I would love for it to be something different. I would love if we shifted this to a just more inclusive feeling for all. So consider saying instead of, hey, it's like you're one of the guys, just, I enjoy hanging out with you. Boom. Thanks, everyone. This was brought to you by the LA Collusion, a society of magicians of all backgrounds focused on improving the art of magic through culture, creativity, and communication. The link is in the show notes. The Historical Women segment is sponsored by the Penguin Magic Podcast, hosted by Eric Tate. Nell Odella Newton, or as we know her now, Del Odell, was born October 2nd, 1897 in Wisconsin, although later she did try to fudge that to make herself seem younger, and no shame in that. She started learning magic at a very young age. She learned magic from her dad, who ran a traveling circus show. Del Odell was known for her clever rhymes that she often commissioned writers to write and which were occasionally published in Genie magazine. Del Odell was also known for her amazing custom props that were often built by her husband, elaborate costumes, and her very clever promotional material, including her Dellers, not dollars, but Dellers, because her name is Del Odell. Get it? Anyway, it was her own form of currency with her face on it and funny puns printed on. I have a couple that are framed thanks to a pretty awesome friend, and they're just like one of my most prized possessions. Del Odell is amazing. Her TV show, The Del Odell Show, aired September 14th, 1951. She wrote a column in Linking Ring called Delightful. Get it? Oh my gosh, so many puns. She has a trick published in Volume 4 of Tarbell and wrote many books, including Presenting Magical Moments and On Both Sides of the Footlights. She and her husband purchased Abbott's Magic Shop in 1950 on Sunset Boulevard in LA, not the one in Colon, Michigan. It was renamed The Del Odell Magic Shop. She sadly passed away from cancer in February of 1962. She was 64 years old. And even leading up to her passing, she performed a show just 2 days before. This segment is sponsored by the Penguin Magic Podcast, hosted by Eric Tate. If you listen to the Penguin Magic Podcast, you can get a 25% discount code on the featured download of the week. You can hear stories from your favorite magicians behind the scenes at Penguin and save money on some of the best new magic. Visit podcast.penguinmagic.com to find out more. The Books to Read segment this week is brought to you by A Bunch of Books. It's the Eli Marks Mystery Series. I just love Del O'Dell so much. There was a lot of emotion in that stammer because I just think she's amazing, or was amazing. And I'm so happy that a book was written about her amazing life, not just by her, but by an outside source who can look back on history and see some of her amazing work. Her work is just inspirational, it's interesting, and something I just really recommend we all get to know a bit more. Check out this book by Michael Claxton, Don't Fool Yourself, The Magical Life of Del O'Dell. This segment was sponsored by the Eli Marks Mystery Series. Teller of Penn and Teller had this to say: I liked the accurate behind-the-scenes aspect of it. Usually magic detective stories don't really have a clue about the mentality and preoccupations of magicians. Yours is true to life. You can pick up the first book in the Eli Marks Mystery Series, The Ambitious Card, for just 99 cents. So go grab your copy at elimarksmysteries.com. That's E-L-I-M-A-R-K-S mysteries.com.
We have a Patreon question from our good buddy Rob Belchunas, who has asked a question in every single episode. And Rob Belchunas asks, in your travels, you teach children that helping women brings good luck, and how can that message be delivered specifically in America?
Well, starting a superstition is easy. You know, here in the Virgin Islands, it's bad luck to put your purse on the floor. I guarantee you, you will never put your purse on the floor again. You've now heard that it's bad luck. And you'll start to do it, and you'll go, no, 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 and you'll put it someplace else. No matter where you go in the world, if I say to someone, what happens if you break a mirror? They say, bad luck. I say, how much bad luck? They say, 7 years. Why do they know that? You know why it's 7 years bad luck to break a mirror? Because 7 years used to be the amount of time it took a family to save up enough money to get the silvering for a mirror. That was about the average time a married couple could get a mirror around their seventh year. So that's where 7 years came in. But why do people know that? There's a terrible expression. So whenever I say thank you to somebody, especially if it's a man, I say, well, thank you. You know, where I come from, they say, if you help a woman, you'll have good luck. Enjoy your luck. I never just say helping women brings good luck.
Yeah.
Or helping women brings good things. Sometimes I don't say luck because some people, especially hardcore Christians here in the Caribbean, believe that luck and superstition is against God. So I change it to good things. But luck is just a thing. Luck, like love, is undefinable. Luck is a series of events. And yes, if you're nice to women, they're nicer to you, so you feel lucky, right? But luck is not like this mysterious, magical power. But for some people, I'll change the phrasing depending on the culture. So the best thing that you can do is to repeat the phrase, helping women brings good luck, in a way that it's relevant. If you just say it casually and somebody overhears it twice, they're like, oh, that must be a real thing. But I always preface it, where I come from, they say, so that you've heard about a superstition elsewhere and you believe it really is a superstition. And then it becomes a superstition to you. Because what's the difference between a superstition and a religion? A religion is just a bunch of them put together.
I love right? that. Yep.
And we all need guidance and we all have a supernatural hero. And if your supernatural hero is whatever it is, I mean, it can be your imagination, it can be an imagining, or it can be a God story. But almost all God stories start with something that is unexplainable so that people will pay attention. Because we don't have very much wonder in the world. One of the reasons magic is so popular now is because we Google instead of wonder. I mean, what I think of creativity is sitting alone in a room and coming up with something. What your generation thinks of creativity is really just curating. You go on Pinterest, you see 15 ideas. You go here, you see 15 ideas. You pick the best ones and combine them.
Yeah.
So many people write papers or speeches, like Jason Silva is one of my favorite speakers, but all he does is say, and Plato would say, blah, 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 blah. And the Dalai Lama would say, blah, 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 blah. And according to blah, blah, blah. And he lines together 45 quotes that do make a point when he hasn't got a freaking original thought in it. And you guys think a DJ has talent. There's no talent in being a DJ. I'm sorry, but between records, I'm sorry. It's an order of songs. You are not an artist. And you are not an artist if you just use other people's ideas. I'm sorry. You're not even a craftsperson if you just use other people's ideas. You're just out there kind of doing your thing. I have so many friends who think that they're artists who have never actually created anything. They've only curated other people's ideas, which I think is very sad, but you can't get around it. You have no practice. Your generation has no practice at actually sitting around and starting from nothing and coming up with an idea. And why should you? There's all these things available to you to find out. So it's a different story. So we have an evolutionary difference in creativity. And then there is, of course, the new challenge of doing a show and have somebody Google how it's done.
Right.
I mean, the idiots who post their trick up and say, this is the sub trunk. Why would you name the effect that you are doing on the internet so people can Google it by name and find it? My origami box is listed as the shrinking lady. Because if you put origami box, somebody's got it exposed on the internet. You don't have the opportunity to necessarily not curate. I mean, some of you I'm sure still do, but who knows where the ideas come from. But your challenge is to find ways to present it in such a way that you're not Googleable.
Mm-hmm.
One of my solutions is this. I have a contest, especially if I have children, like boys, young boys in my show. I have a contest at the beginning of the show. I say, okay, now, I know some of you are going to figure out some of my tricks and some of you aren't. And some of you are going to be very proud to tell me how they work. But you can't win the contest if you shout it out. So anybody who wants to be in the contest, take a piece of paper and a pencil. Write down 1 to 10, because there's 10 tricks. Write down how you think it worked. And the person who gets the most right wins this prize. And then nobody shouts it out and nobody says, here it is on Google, until the end of the show. And then they say, what about the contest? And I say, oh, canceled. Have a nice night. So, but yeah, but I mean, and that's the way I get around being Googled and being interrupted in my show with people with stupid knowledge. But is that the way to do it? I don't know how other people get around it.
My tactic has always been just doing things that you can't easily, like you said, we're a shrinking lady. So like you can't Google how do you restore two paper hearts with a piece of each other's in it. You can't Google how did she not win the date. So it's really hard to define, I think. So that's been always my approach. But even right, so.
And if you did torn and restored newspaper, it'd be so easy. Change it to hearts and that's your, exactly. That's me, right?
But even so, like being on Fool Us, people render guesses all the time and like, oh, here's how she did it. And some of them are right and some of them are very wrong because they also edit the video very appropriately to make sure it's not blatantly showing you any clues to the method, which is brilliant on their part. But yeah, for the most part, I have friends who performed in the college market and they were doing a routine. It was a great routine. And somebody just Googled a description of the routine and boom was the method. So that got taken out of their show immediately. So that stuff happens all the time.
And if we would establish copyright as legitimate magic, all of those amateurs could get taken off of YouTube. I don't know why somebody doesn't make it a project of it. You only have to have 3 complaints against your channel and your channel gets shut down, even if they're not legitimate complaints. They shut down your channel and then that person has to send an affidavit that says, no, this is my intellectual property. And if they can't, they have to remove it, right? And these people who expose magic have 85 posts and magic is just one. If they get some complaints, they'd rather take away that magic post than have their channel shut down because it's a big hassle to get it put back on. I don't know why the IBM doesn't have a committee or the SEM doesn't have a committee of people going through and just complaining. That's Matrix. That's not your material. That belongs to so-and-so. It's published in this book and this is who's the copyright of it. Remove it. I don't know why there's not a committee removing magic from the internet in that way. And then the other part of it is so many members of the SAM and IBM who are wannabes or quasi-pros put a routine on and they show it and then they expose it or they don't expose it. But if you join the SAM or the IBM, you sign something that says, I will not expose magic.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, well, I'm teaching. I don't care you're teaching. You're exposing and you're not teaching. You know, it's a different thing. I think that the magician community has fallen very short when it comes to attacking YouTube exposure. If I want to expose the high yield card step on the internet, I have the right to. I own it, but nobody else does. And nobody else has the right to perform it without my permission. Even if they went to my lecture, even if they bought my lecture notes, or even if they bought a book that it's in, that just buys the right to learn about it and study it, not to perform it technically, which is the same, I think, on YouTube. I'm very surprised that somebody hasn't stepped up and done that. Even if it isn't 100% effective, like maybe we couldn't prove copyrights, if we had a committee of people making complaints, we'd get rid of 90% of the problem. And also, it's really easy to learn magic now because there's videotapes. When I learned magic, you had to pull it out of a book.
Yeah.
It was hard.
Uh-huh.
Right? So the difference between the ability to learn magic, I think it's overexposed. It's a whole different system now. And it's fine that magic is really popular on one level, but it's a shame. It was really fun. When I was your age, most people had never seen a live magician. It was really fun. Cause to Wonder itself only works in communities that have no television and no media and are illiterate. When I went to Thailand in my 20s, people backed away from me slowly when I vanished a coin because they thought, oh, you do that. Not how do you do that? Then Thailand got electricity and TV. And I went back 12 years later and I do magic and people would say, oh, Mayakon, Mayakon. Because they'd seen it on TV and they knew of it as an art form. And there were people hustling magic tricks in the streets to sell them. Mm-hmm. But it was really interesting to meet a culture of people who were afraid of my magic. And then 12 years later, celebrating it. So Cause to Wonder won't work in a 10 or 15 years. People are like, well, why don't you do it in America? Why don't you do it in Europe? I'm like, no, that's just a free magic show. If you do it in a place where there's no literacy, it's truly a discussion. For every person that sees me make a coin disappear or a rock disappear in Africa, they have told that story 1,000 times and they're still telling it, even if it's 10 years later, because it's one of the most exciting things that ever happened.
Yeah. So then it matters and it's impactful. You actually made it.
And with it is the message, because they wave their finger over it. And instead of saying abracadabra, which of course, you know, abracadabra means I speak, I shall create. Right. Which is really words are powerful.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a really good place to, I'm going to say end. So we end every episode the exact same way, which is our lightning round. So I have just some fun, silly questions to end it. You can choose to answer these how you want. So you can either answer them with a single word or you can answer them just as Max Maven does in 2 hours per question. I love it. Here we go. Ready?
Yes.
Okay. What's your favorite place you've traveled to?
No idea. No idea. I'm at like 80 countries and some of them I've been a dozen times. So I can't pick a place. It's usually where I am at the moment.
I love that. Where's a place that you haven't gone yet but want to?
No place. Heaven?
Mm-hmm. That's much more deep than most people and I love it.
But I mean, any place I want to go, I've been, right?
Good point. Yep, good point. Great. What's a piece of advice you would give for a woman who's just now getting into magic?
Enjoy yourself.
I like it. Big dogs or little dogs?
Big dogs in life, little dogs for travel.
Oh, I like that. That's good. You have like a dog for every occasion. Nice.
I wish I had a dog.
Oh, they're great. Next time you're in LA when there's not a pandemic, you must come. Because my dog loves people, but specifically loves women, and he will sit on you. And if you're okay with it, you should come over. It will be great. Anyway, if you could eat one dessert for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Chocolate wafer cream cake, which is my birthday cake. If you know me on my birthday, which is 24/7, not every day of the week, but the 24th of the 7th month. Chocolate cream cake. And I like earrings. You may send me earrings. Thank you, Stephen Minch.
Oh, well, this is good to know. Now you're going to be getting a lot of earrings after this podcast comes out. Last question. How can people find out either more about you or find out more on how to support Cause to Wonder?
Cause to Wonder needs all kinds of support. If you have a talent or skill or time, we certainly would like your help, but only if you're the kind of volunteer that's self-starting. Because half of the volunteers that we get are terrific. And the other ones, I can't maintain. I'm not in the business of managing people. We certainly need financial support, but more we need emotional support, as in if you can introduce the idea to a newspaper or a magazine, because we have to work by invitation. We need to be invited, like we're invited to go to Mozambique, or we're next place we're invited to go is Malawi, but the pandemic has stopped it. But if we're not invited in, you can't do it. So the most thing that we can use is introductions and financial support. And you can go to wonder.org.
CauseToWonder.org. Fantastic. Lisa, thank you so, so much. This was amazing.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to watch you become who you are. It has. It's been really great to watch. I mean, you don't know, right? You don't know what it's like. You just wait. You just wait and see.
It's so weird. I'm like, this is a weird compliment. Like, I know, and a kind compliment, but it's like, oh.
Well, how many people are really watching you, right?
Well, apparently you are, and I wasn't.
Well, only because you said, look at me. I'm here. I'm going to buy you lunch. I thought it was the sweetest thing ever, right? Because I knew that lunch cost you a half a day's work. It was the sweetest thing ever. You bought me lunch, and the questions that you asked me at lunch were painfully obvious to me that you were going to succeed because of the nature of the questions that you asked. So it was really fun to watch, right? And the fact that you are one of the creatives, right? You didn't copy anybody, right?
I don't think so.
No, you didn't pander. You didn't copy. On no level do you appear to have sold out to social pressure. I'm sure you know ways that you have. But
yeah,
in the overall professional sense, it's been a nice ride. I believe that you are not even close to your prime yet.
Thanks. Yeah. I'm going to dine out on that for a long time, aren't I?
Well, you know, it ebbs and flows. Don't worry about it. If your creativity stops for a while, it comes back. But it is supposed to go. And it's okay to hate magic and not want to deal with it for a while and just do it as a job and come back to it. If you don't ebb and flow, you don't get good.
Boom. Okay, so then do you want to say what you want to say?
Oh, yes. I own the intellectual property of this podcast. There's nothing about this that can be reproduced outside of our conversation without my written permission and without compensation.
Cool. And that's the episode. Don't forget to follow us on the socials at SheZamPod. For all things swag, head over to our website at SheZamPod.com for shirts, pins, and that coveted Don't Touch Me skateboard. You know you need it. If you are interested in the bonus content for this episode and future episodes, plus exclusive swag designs, behind-the-scenes content, and shoutouts in episodes, become a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/SheZamPod. Links to everything are in our show notes. You can also sponsor one of our many segments this season. I still have some spots left, so please email me at shezampod@gmail.com if you'd like to find out more. Shazam is sponsored in part by the Society of American Magicians and the International Brotherhood of Magicians. Thank you to the SAM and the IBM for your support. Our audio producer is Chris Combs. The Shazam theme song is recorded and produced by Kevin Karikas with vocals by Jonah Fagel. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you soon. Bye.